Bournemouth, England, in 1885, Robert Louis Stevenson was recovering from an illness. Trapped in a nightmare, he cried out in his sleep. His wife Fanny woke him up, and he immediately began to write out the nightmare. We know it as the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There are some great movie versions of the tale. My favorites are the classics, the 1931 Frederick March, the 1941 Spencer Tracy version. But if you've only seen the movies, you may not know that in the original story, Mr. Hyde is significantly smaller than Dr. Jekyll. Hyde lives inside Jekyll, a metaphor for an undisciplined monster of unfettered passion that lives within us all. Jekyll doesn't so much become Hyde as let him out. In the work of Freud, there's a Mr. Hyde too. It's the id, what he calls the dark, inaccessible part of our personality, a chaos, a cauldron full of seething of excitations. Is that what emotion is? That part of us that we have to suppress? There's a standard picture in which reason and the emotions are opposing parts of the mind, or the soul. On that view, reason is at war with the emotions. Pursuit of rationality demands that reason win and emotion lose. The ideal of rationality is Mr. Spock of Star Trek, devoted to a Vulcan life of logic and suppression of emotion. In this lecture, I'll talk about what can be said for such a view, and also ways in which it turns out to be incomplete. The ancient Greek philosophers are often cited as sources for the view of reason as at war with the emotions. In the Republic, Plato develops a tripartite theory of the soul. Its three elements are nous, epithumia, and thumos. None of these is easily translated, though nous is roughly reason, epithumia is appetite or passion, and thumos is the spirit of fortitude shown in battle. Plato's tripartite soul is paralleled by his tripartite theory of society, which has corresponding social classes. But Plato makes it perfectly clear who he thinks should be in control. He pictures the triumvirate as a charioteer with two horses, reason reigning in the good horse of thumos, fortitude, and the bad horse of the passions. This theme is strongest in the Stoics, both Greek and Roman. Epictetus talks of the stronger emotions, sorrows, griefs, and envies, as passions that make it impossible for us to even listen to reason. Emotions corrupt judgment. The wise man would outgrow emotion, maintaining a stoically calm indifference in the face of both the greatest good fortune and the greatest disaster. The Stoic sage was supposed to be equally indifferent to wealth and poverty, honor and disgrace, even pleasure and pain. The passions are classically thought of as things that happen to us, things we suffer rather than things we do. That classic picture of reason at war with the passions and too often losing echoes down the centuries. Erasmus laments that we've been given far more passion than reason. He estimates the ratio as 24 to 1. Shakespeare has Hamlet say, "Give me that man that is not passion's slave, and I will wear him in my heart's core." Is emotion the enemy of rationality? To at least some extent, the answer is yes. In emotional contexts, rationality can indeed suffer. Consider stress. There were a series of army tests done in the 1960s to measure performance under stress. You could say performance under the emotion of fear. These are the Birkin studies. In one scenario, new military recruits were taken up in a plane and told they were participating in a study on the effects of high altitude. Once in the air, the plane began to yaw wildly. They saw one of the engines sputter and then stop. Through the intercom, they heard reports of repeated malfunctions. And in typical Army style, they were then told to fill out some forms. One was labeled emergency data form. It looked like a last will and testament with complicated questions about what to do with their personal possessions. The other was a test measuring retention of the ditching procedures they had read before takeoff. So how well did they follow the procedures on the first form compared to people who weren't under stress? How well did they remember the ditching procedures? Not well. The cognitive abilities required in the first task decreased by 10%. Memory failed by almost a third. In another test, Birkin had individual soldiers led down winding roads to isolated wilderness areas as part of a simulated tactical exercise, a war game. But they then heard radio reports that live shells were landing off target. A series of explosions went off around them, progressively coming closer. Their only way to communicate with headquarters was with a radio transmitter. But they discovered it was broken. They had to fix it. How long did it take to go through the steps required to fix the transmitter? Under conditions of no stress, the phone was fixed in a couple of minutes. When you think you're being shelled, it takes significantly longer. 5 minutes. 7 minutes. Studies on eyewitness testimony have shown that stress reduces memory efficiency, memory accuracy. In a study by Johnson and Scott, people show up for an experiment and are left waiting in the receptionist's office. In one case, the receptionist goes into the next room. The subjects overhear a conversation about an equipment failure. A man comes out with a pen in his hand and his hands covered with grease. He says something, oh brother, maybe, and leaves. In the other case, with a different group of subjects, they hear an angry interaction that ends with chairs crashing and bottles breaking. Man comes out with a letter opener in his hands, and his hands covered with blood. He says, oh, brother, and leaves. Subjects were then asked to pick the man they saw from a lineup. In the case with the pen and the grease, 49% were able to identify him correctly. In the case with the letter opener and the blood, only 33% were able to do so. What holds for stress holds for strong emotion generally. It can negatively impact cognitive capacity, attention, memory, all the things required for rational decision making. You can probably cite cases from your own experience when you made the wrong decision because you were under stress at the time, or swayed by fear, or grief, or sexual passion, or incredibly angry. I know that I can. Now I want to give you the other side of the picture. There are certainly cases in which emotion runs amok, swamping rationality. But it doesn't look like we should simply try to get rid of emotion. Where would we be without it? The neuroscientist Antonio Damasio speaks of a patient he calls Elliot, who suffered damage to a central portion of his frontal lobes just above the eye sockets. That's a region associated with judgment. But Elliot aced all the rationality tests. Logical reasoning was intact. His memory functioned normally. His language abilities were perfectly normal. He passed tests on means-end reasoning and on expected consequences of particular actions. He passed tests on standard ethical principle, all with flying colors. But Elliot's life had become a total mess. It was hard for him to get out of bed in the morning. He couldn't keep a job because he couldn't order priorities. He would spend incredible amounts of time on something trivial while ignoring the things that were really important. He couldn't make effective plans for the next few hours, let alone the next few days or months. He didn't seem to learn from his mistakes. The diagnosis wasn't a lack of reason. It was a lack of emotion. Damasio says that he never saw a tinge of emotion from Elliot throughout their interaction. No sadness, no impatience, no frustration. Everything had the same emotional tone to him. Personal triumph meant no more than personal disaster. Neither meant much of anything. Elliot was, in a sense, the perfect stoic. Everything was met with the same passionless equanimity. The impact of that lack of emotion on personal decision-making and planning capacities was devastating. Because everything had the same emotional tone, Elliot had no reason to prioritize, no reason to do one thing rather than another. Even after tests that probed his ability to conceive alternatives, and to trace predictable consequences, he'd say, "But I still wouldn't know what to do." Reason without emotion seems to be blind. Why? Because emotion is tied to value. The psychologists call it valence. The things we love are the things we value positively, those that have a strong positive valence. The things we hate or fear or despise are those that have a strong negative valence. Valence is crucial for action. We need it in order to decide what to do, and we need it in order to follow through and do it. Without the sense of value that's embodied in emotion, we become like Eliot. Heuristics are simple rules of action or rules of thumb, immediate and effective in ways that don't require calculation or deliberation. It's been proposed that that's what emotions are, heuristics that give us the immediate value judgments required for action. One of the earliest theoretical studies of the emotions came from Charles Darwin. 13 years after he wrote The Origin of Species, 13 years before Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, Darwin wrote The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. As the title makes clear, Darwin thought of emotion as something inherited from our evolutionary ancestors. Such a view makes sense if emotions are a fast and frugal heuristic for value in action. In dangerous situations, we may not have time to think through all options, weighing their comparative consequences, figuring out the best long-term action. In dangerous situations, as the train is roaring toward us, for example, we just need to get out of the way fast. Fear motivates precisely that. Anger gives us a fast and frugal reaction when threatened. Without emotions as value heuristics, we couldn't act as quickly and decisively as we often need to. What we learn from Eliot is that without emotions, we'd lose decision-making and appropriateness of action entirely. So perhaps emotions should rule. The 18th century philosopher David Hume offers an extreme form of that claim. Value, Hume says, comes not from reason, but from something else. It is not contrary to reason, Hume says, to prefer the destruction of the whole world to the scratching of my finger. That's an issue of value, not an issue of reason. So Hume turns Plato's claim completely on its head. It's not reason that should rule, he says, but the passions. Quote, "Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions, and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them." So which is it? Are emotions the enemy of reason, to be subjugated and suppressed? Or is Hume right? Is it emotions that should be in control? When it comes to fallacies, we'll call that a false dilemma. A false dilemma relies on a bogus problem setup. Which is it to be, A or B, A or B, when in fact those are not your only options? Are emotions the enemy of reason, to be subjugated and suppressed? Or should emotions be in control? The truth seems to be neither. In full and rational decision and full and rational action, both emotion and what we think of as pure logic have important parts to play. We need both cool rationality and hot thought. Lab studies have shown that cognitive performance can decay in situations of high emotion and high stress. But looked at as a whole, the evidence on rationality and emotion is significantly more nuanced. For many people, at least up to a point, emotional arousal actually improves performance. This is a familiar fact among athletes. That's what pep talks in the locker room are all about: getting players involved, arousing aggression toward their competitors, getting them emotionally pumped and raring to win. Athletes in competition often want performance stress. It brings out their best performance. Beyond a certain point, however, stress becomes overstress. With too much stress, performance declines quickly. In the case of both emotion and stress, that pattern of performance is known as the inverted U. Performance rises on one side of the upside-down U, stays fairly high for a stretch, but then plummets dramatically. A mild level of emotion and even stress seems necessary for alertness and full involvement. But in conditions of excessive emotion and excessive stress, performance declines. The middle stretch of highest performance is surprisingly wide. Earlier in the lecture, I mentioned the Birkin tests on battlefield stress. As the explosions come nearer and nearer to your position, you get worse and worse at being able to fix the radio transmitter. Those studies were done in the early 1960s. Our ethical standards for human experimentation are stricter now. It's extremely unlikely that any human experimentation review board would allow those experiments today, even in the military. When researchers tried more recently to construct a study regarding cognitive performance under battlefield stress, they found their hands were tied. They weren't allowed to use the kind of deception that Birkin did and weren't allowed to put subjects under that kind of stress. They were restricted to fairly limited stress situations, and with limited stress, they saw no decrease in performance. In the course of testing, however, it just so happened that one of the soldiers thought he was having a serious medical problem. There the stress was high. There the stress was real. And there the researchers did see a drastic decline in cognitive performance. Across the middle span of the inverted U, performance can stay high despite increase in emotional stress. But even if the level of performance doesn't decrease along that plateau, a number of investigators have noted that the kind of performance changes. The kinds of problem-solving strategies we employ tend to change as stress increases. Without stress, people tend to rely on analysis of the problem, both wide and deep. They consider lots of options and think each of them through. We can think of that as a purely analytical approach. Under stress, in contrast, people attend to the general outline of the problem rather than a wide range of specifics. They focus on significantly fewer options. We can think of that as the intuitive approach. You can portray that intuitive approach with either a negative or a positive spin. The negative spin, there's a reduction in the careful consideration of alternative options. There's a reduction in tracking options at length, and a corresponding reduction in the use of working memory and attention to detail. The positive spin, there's an increase in the focus of attention to just the critical issues and elements, avoiding the inessential parts. Different people, of course, may react differently in emotionally loaded situations. In very similar circumstances, some people use an intuitive approach. Others use an analytic approach. Interestingly enough, both those strategies may prove successful. Here, for example, are two cases. The USS Samuel B. Roberts was operating in the Persian Gulf when it struck a mine, caught fire, and began to sink. The captain, Paul Rynn, analyzed the situation and pursued a course of action directly opposed to Navy protocol. He estimated how much water the ship would take on and still stay afloat, and realized the ship would sink before the crew could put out the fire. He therefore directed the crew to make keeping the ship afloat the first priority. Putting out the fire became secondary. He is on record as saying that he arrived at that decision coolly and analytically. But there's also the case of a United DC-10 traveling from Denver to Chicago. The hydraulic system and maneuverability suddenly failed. Captain Al Hayes and his crew had to come up with a new way to fly the plane using the throttles and a limited number of environmental cues. That wasn't in their training. They landed safely, but attributed their success entirely to intuitive decision-making under stress. They said it wasn't analysis, it was intuition. One of the interesting things about those two cases is that an emotional decision in the first case, fire, might have led to disaster. Time spent on analysis in the second case might have led to disaster as well. So, should emotion be the slave of reason, or reason the slave of emotion? The answer seems to be neither. Both are involved in our decision-making, though perhaps in different ways, in different situations. Both should be involved in our decision-making. The rational thing to do is to jettison neither cool analytical rationality nor the fast and frugal heuristics of intuitive emotional reaction. The rational thing is to take advantage of both. There are two extremes that we should clearly avoid. One is Eliot's, decision-making and living in general so devoid of emotion that it's devoid of value. The other extreme is decision-making under such extremes of emotion or stress that rationality can no longer get a grip. Human decision-making seems best when it's between those two extremes. We're at our best when we can use all the tools at our disposal. Some recent research seems to confirm that conclusion in terms of brain studies. Researchers noted something like the two approaches, the analytical and the intuitive, though in the very different context of rational and irrational gambling. It turns out that some people gamble almost entirely with their gut. They handle risk inconsistently, and they make some fairly major mistakes. They do poorly. What the researchers found was that in those cases, the primary activation was in the amygdala. The amygdala lies at the core of what's known as the old brain, a feature we share with animals all the way down to reptiles. It's long been known to be a primary activator of emotion. Brain scans of those who gambled intuitively and irrationally showed fairly little action in the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is a part of the new brain that distinguishes us and higher primates. That part of the brain is not developed in lower animals. It's long been associated with higher order executive processes and emotional control. So what does brain activity look like in more rational decisions? It's not that the prefrontal cortex is turned on and the amygdala is turned off. What the researchers found was that the amygdala was active in both groups. What the rational players had that the irrational gut players did not was the use of both parts of the brain, emotionally intuitive and rationally controlling. Players who used both parts of their brain did much better. Of course, I'm not advocating gambling with either part or the whole of your brain. We'll return to the entire topic of probability in a later lecture. The amygdala is associated with emotion, the prefrontal cortex with control. Rational decision-making seems to require both. In Elliot's case, the amygdala wasn't impacted, but in his case, it appears that the ability to integrate emotion into decision-making was. The fact that the old brain amygdala is activated in emotion certainly fits the Darwinian view that emotions are fast and frugal heuristics for quick action that we've inherited from our evolutionary ancestors. It also says something about how we, who have both amygdala and prefrontal cortex, should go about making different kinds of decisions. Some decisions demand instantaneous action in an immediate context. For those, we can rely on the fast and frugal heuristics of gut instinct and emotional response. But some decisions, human decisions at least, aren't about what to do immediately. Some decisions are about what to do in the next few months, or over the next 5 years, or in the course of a lifetime. For those kinds of decisions, we don't need to rely on emotion alone. For those kinds of decisions, we have every reason to recruit the analytical and reflective abilities of the prefrontal cortex. In those kinds of cases, it would be wrong not to consider lots of options. It would be wrong not to think through potential consequences in detail and depth. For extremely short-range decisions, it's a good thing that we have immediate emotional responses. For long-range decisions, it's a good thing we have those other analytical abilities as well. At an earlier point, I appealed to your experience, to the fact that all of us have made poor decisions in the heat of passion, in extreme anger or grief, for example. If you think back on some of your bad decisions, I think you'll find that the problem may have been making long-range decisions with only a short-range tool. So how should we make decisions in emotionally stressed situations? We don't have all the answers, and there's a lot about emotion we don't know. But perhaps we can at least assemble a few pointers. One of the things we know is that decision-making can decay in conditions of extreme emotional stress. So here's a simple lesson. Avoid decision-making in those kinds of situations. Plan things so that you won't have to make decisions, particularly long-range decisions, in predictable conditions of extreme emotional stress. That's what pre-planning for funeral arrangements is all about. If you and those you love can sit down and make decisions now, you can make them more rationally than when, inevitably, you'll be impacted by devastating loss and deep grief. That's also what living wills and declarations regarding your future health care are all about. If you make those decisions now, you can use your entire brain. If you're forced to make those decisions in a crisis, you won't have that luxury. A standard picture of rational decision-making has you write up a list of pros and cons. You're then supposed to balance the pros against the cons. Darwin actually did this when deciding whether he should get married. He wrote up the pros of staying a bachelor, freedom to go where he liked, choice of society and little of it, he said, conversation of clever men at clubs. He wrote up the cons: no children, no one to care for you in old age. What's the use of working? The contemporary philosopher Paul Thagard has paid a great deal of attention to hot thought, to a picture of decision-making that integrates both emotion and analytic rationality. Thagard thinks that list-making like Darwin isn't a bad idea, but he emphasizes several crucial elements. First, goals and alternatives have to be clearly laid out. You should be careful to explore all alternatives. Expectation of consequences should be based on the best available evidence. Second, value has to be clearly in there. What is the importance of different goals? Use emotional response as an indicator, but be aware of ways in which short-term emotion might be a bad indicator for long-term goals. Here's the interesting part. As you consider things in this light, Thagard recommends monitoring your own emotional reactions in the process. If the rational considerations seem to lean one way, are you disappointed? If they lean another way, does that make you anxious? Emotional response in the midst of the attempt at rational decision-making is telling you something. It's telling you something about what you value. You may discover that you value things in different ways than you thought you did. Pay attention to what those reactions are telling you about what you really value. Include that in the mix. What I've been emphasizing as the take-home message is that optimal decision-making seems to involve both reason and the emotions. Despite our initial portrayal of Plato in terms of a conflict between reason and emotion, I think that integration of the two is his message as well. The Stoics seem to want to flatten emotion entirely. But Plato's image is of a charioteer and two horses. He wants the charioteer to remain in control, but that chariot is going to go nowhere without the horses. Let me leave you with a fascinating piece of experimentation regarding short-term emotional response and long-term control. This is the marshmallow test developed at Stanford in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Individual nursery school children were brought into a room. A marshmallow was put in front of them. They were offered a choice. They could eat that marshmallow right away, or they could wait for a few minutes while the researcher left the room. If they waited, they'd get another marshmallow when the researcher came back and could eat them both. If they wanted to eat the first marshmallow before the researcher got back, they were told to ring a bell. The researcher would come back, and they could eat that first marshmallow, but they wouldn't get a second one. Some kids ate the single marshmallow immediately. Some didn't even bother to ring the bell. Some kids restrained themselves by deliberately looking away, or by merely smelling the marshmallow, or poking it, licking their fingers. That kind of restraint indicates a capacity for deferred gratification, for rational control of emotion in decision making. The interesting thing in the Stanford study is that those kids were tracked through later life. Researchers asked just about any question they could think of. How well did they do in school years later? How well could they cope with life's inevitable problems? What did they get on the SATs? What they found was that the kids who couldn't wait for the second marshmallow seemed to have more behavioral problems later. They had trouble maintaining attention. They had trouble maintaining friends. They didn't handle stress as well. The kid who could wait 15 minutes for a second marshmallow had SAT scores 200 points higher than the kid who could only wait 30 seconds. It may be that capacity for deferred gratification is set early in life, but it may be that we can cultivate it even now. In order to increase rationality in our decision making, we should perhaps all learn to wait for that second marshmallow. In the next lecture, I want to reach into the philosopher's toolkit in order to hand you what I think is the most powerful thinking tool of all: conceptual visualization.